down the ground.
We're
receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 221.ES0601, certificate number 49146. The Chronophile.
Now that we know we can cope with nature's most hostile actions of earthquakes, hurricanes, great Arctic snow loads, and now that we know how to get the best mathematics to get the most volume with the least. Next thing is, how do we produce the surfaces that will do this with in the highest speed in the most economical, effective manner?
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you before. Have we talked about this? But you once went on a walk across Europe. Did you know that?
You know, it's kind of been exaggerated. It's been blown out of proportion.
It's going to turn out you actually took a bus most of the way. You walked for like 3 hours and were like, this blows.
Yeah, I left the train station in Bern and walked around Bern, and then I was like, whew.
All right.
Back to the train station.
I'm
going to
get a coffee and for years, decades maybe, you've kind of been shaping that experience, as I understand it, into a possible book of some kind, right?
Yeah, I kept I was at the University of Washington at the time, and a big part of the initial plan was that I was going to do it as the beginning of a thesis. I was going to write a thesis based on it, and so I kept a journal the whole time. I sent missives back to the University of Washington daily, which were published.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You're like a polar explorer.
I was.
We have reached Innsbruck.
I did exactly that.
Morale is high.
Every issue for but it was, the problem is I was doing it over the summer. So it was the summer edition of the UW Daily, not the, it wasn't like back to school issue.
Wait, it actually appeared in the Daily?
It did.
Assuming this was on some departmental bulletin board nobody saw.
No, it
you
was
had a column.
I did. It was in the published paper.
Our man in Europe, John Roderick.
Here's my dispatch from Romania.
Brussels.
And so the CHID department was...
CHID? Explain for the people.
I'm sorry. CHID is a University of Washington
racial
major.
Slur.
It's a racial slur. It's our mascot, the CHID. It's a small major called the Comparative History of Ideas. So it's in...
Shouldn't it be CHOI?
It should, okay. but I wasn't there when they decided this.
In Korean?
When I first joined the CHID department, it was very small. There were only like 40 people in the department. But it's what my degree ultimately was in when I finally graduated in 2015 after 35 years of college.
Because you finally got back from Europe. You're on a tramp steamer.
But then I brought the journal back, and I'm kind of an earnest guy. I believe the children are our future, as you know.
You wear your heart on your sleeve.
I do. I get excited about things. I often find myself standing up going, oh my God, wow. And then I look around and everybody else is glowering and going, boo.
But aren't you kind of a Gen X ironist too?
I am super, super. And it's what puts me outside. It's what makes me not punk rock. Because I'm such a goober.
You're not world weary enough.
Yeah, and I wasn't when I was 21, but when I was in school, like, I loved pop quizzes, like, whoa, pop quiz, how fun, and then I'd look around and everybody...
Nobody wants to give you a high five.
No, they're just hating me. The number of high fives that I've been left hanging over the years. I loved standardized tests. like the Iowa Basics. Oh, Jiminy Christmas.
It's a thing. What a human. It's kind of interesting. There is out there a human being who has been left hanging more than any other person.
Oh, for sure. And I don't think that's me.
You don't think you're the world
record holder? No, because I'm also cool.
I see. This would be an uncool, but this has to be an uncool person who also has no clue, or they would stop offering the high five.
Yeah, and they have to be around a lot of people that they're putting high fives up to all the time.
Right. If you're super uncool, who are you even doing exactly that to? Your wife pillow.
So you have to be there. I mean, it might be somebody, it might be like Jack from Twitter or Elon Musk. I mean, how many high fives? I guess he's getting all the high fives now.
If you're high-fiving people you pay, you never get left hanging.
But so then I started working on it as a book, taking my notes and trying to turn it into a book. But the problem was I couldn't stop talking about Hitler because I'm walking across Europe, you know, and I'm just like, well, you know, Hitler.
It's funny how many arenas of your life this problem comes up in.
It's terrible. And so eventually the manuscript got to be 850 pages.
Mein Volk.
Single spaced. And, you know, 400 pages of it are like cool, talking about walking across Europe and all the emotional ups and downs. But then 400 pages of it are like, when the Romans came, you know, it's just stuff that nobody wants. Nobody's going to pick up this book to hear me talking about.
I don't know. It could be one of those Michener books where it's like, for 11 million years, the rains fell. The algae mats formed a dense covering of... It could be that.
It's sort of like that.
Big picture.
Except the problem is, like, I'm a bad historian because I also want to be a pundit. So I'm like, here's what I think the Hungarians were thinking. And then I go into these long...
This is perfect.
Just like, here's what the Hot Hungarians...
Hot take gonzo journalism.
That's what it is. It's what it is. I thought I was Hunter S. Tompkins. Not Tompkins.
Hunter F. Tompkins.
Oh, why is that not a podcast? I thought I was Hunter S. Tompkins. And that I was writing about some sheriff's convention in Las Vegas, but it turned out I... So anyway, I'm still working on it.
You're just Bill Simmons.
I'm actually writing it still. I wake up in the morning sometimes and I work all day. Oh, I'm this... And it's good. It's really good. It's just... It needs an aggressive editor.
And you have the original journals still.
I have the original journals.
Is that the only time in your life you ever journaled?
No.
Or are you an archivist by nature?
I'm not, but I journaled all my travels. So I have...
Oh, that's smart.
I have travel journals from when I went to Outward Bound when I was 13 and from when I hopped freight trains across America when I was 17.
What were you writing on then?
You had a
notebook in your bindle?
Yeah, a notebook in my bindle. I always got those ones. I mean, for the Outward Bound trip, it was, they gave us little journals, but then the freight hopping, I was writing in a spiral notebook with a red Bic pen. And then later the ones in Europe, cause I've done three separate Europe trips, a big long, you know, 9 month long, you know, and I would buy those really cool, like kind of red bound journals that you find in...
It's more like a book.
Yeah, European stationery stores, because I love that stuff. I just have so many...
I have so many empty ones.
If I took all the empty European journals out of my house, I think the whole house would raise 1 foot, like the water table would push the house up.
It's the equivalent of leaving stationery hanging. You're like, hey, notebook, what's up? And then nothing happens.
I know that a lot of Omnibus listeners tire of me talking about my travels.
You traveled across Europe?
But it's just, you know, it's a defining characteristic.
Well, I was just interested in the, because I feel like I had never...
You weren't interested in the 10 minutes that I just spent on...
Well, I didn't care about the haystacks. You talk about that all the time. But I was interested in the documentation angle. Because I didn't realize you were sending dispatches to the Daily like Shackleton.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about documentation lately.
Did you ever keep a journal, a diary?
Yes, but only in the most boring, insufferable periods of my life. I actually went to my garage today.
Oh my God.
And I found this like Korean notebook from the late 80s.
Spiral bound.
It's got a picture of a baseball player and it says, "The Strike Man. We are heart to heart friends." Jongi Wa Yun Pil Spring Note Series. So if...
Oh, wait, but it's meant to be written in right to left. It's backwards.
This is just the back of it for some reason. There must have been something else on the front that I
tore off.
That did not survive.
And so is your diary like Monday, went to school?
At first my handwriting is very good, and then it just and it goes through my freshman year of college, and then I think that's the last time in my life that I ever kept an analog record of any kind. And
you very seldom, if never, talk about your feelings. Is your journal full of your feelings?
It walks a uneasy line where it is not confessional enough to be useful. Like, really, it doesn't have the kind of things that an adolescent is, that your brain is just swirling about. I mean, it has some of them.
Do you read it now and go, God, come on, tell me more.
Well, I remember specifically, like, well, what if somebody sees this? I'm not really going to talk about, like, the friend drama or the girl I'm obsessed with or the thing that just makes me so mad.
The first time you looked in a mirror and saw yourself naked or half naked.
When I was
29.
But there's a level of ironic removal, so as if I'm writing to an imagined audience, but the writer is not any good. So it's just kind of irritating.
I have so much of that writing.
I haven't looked at it in, I'm going to say, since it was written in most cases. Like, this morning was the first time I'd looked at most of it in 30 years.
I'm going to amend my earlier statement, because in my early 20s, when I was drinking heavily, I would go sit in bars and write in spiral-bound notebooks. And I filled probably 7 notebooks. But it's like, again, sort of gonzo, grunge era, spilling my blood and my life out onto the page. And it's so annoying to read it. It's just excruciating. Yeah,
it might have been worse the other way if it really was all just Sturm und Drang.
It was just like, because terrible because of the poetry. The voice directed at an imaginary audience, instead of, like, I wasn't confiding in my diary. I wasn't talking to myself. I was imagining that this was going to be the great American novel. It's awful. Ugh. I sit here shivering, thinking that anyone would ever read it.
Yeah, this is the same tension I felt looking at this morning. And I thought, this has got to go.
But you have it.
It's so embarrassing.
Do you think you would destroy it now?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's so valuable for just the kind of day-to-day, just the mundanity of life and all the stuff that I had totally forgotten. Apparently there's a real play-by-play of the 1988 Seahawks division championship game against the Raiders.
You write the game.
Well, I'm apparently writing as I'm watching it. Wow. So there's some final, some final Dave Craig first down or a sack of the Raiders quarterback or something, where I'm,
Are you writing it breathlessly?
Like, I seem very excited about it.
Who did you think the audience for that was?
I mean, who is the audience for a journal? It's the question. Like, I'm writing in this very kind of arch way, as if, like, dear reader, here's what you need to know about, I went to Arby's today, but you're a teenager with nothing to say and no mastery of the voice. And I find that there's so many things that I've forgotten, like the things that are relevant to my conception of myself at that age. I remember, like, here's me and a couple friends making a movie about imagining Napoleon's redemption on St. Helena in a Christmas Carol kind of format, like a Scrooge retelling with Napoleon that we did for credit in history credit in ninth grade.
Are you going to read a little excerpt of it?
There's really no good excerpt. Napoleon's Christmas Carol is almost complete. It's much better than I thought it'd be. That's not very helpful. But I mean, so I remember that. I remember, where was it? I had it open to a page where I got called into my editor at the faculty advisor of the student newspaper made me redraw a cartoon because it looked too much like the principal. And he said, you can't actually implicate the principal in the cafeteria food. That's not his fault.
Show me your drawings.
Are there drawings?
Are you a doodler?
Oh yeah, big time.
Oh, look at that. It's Captain America.
It looks like it's Captain America.
Except he's really thick.
It's thick with 2 C's, Captain America. The first C is for Captain. There's doodles in all. There's a ton of marginalia. And I think I would write at the end of every day. But there's stuff like that that is part of my sense of who I was in the past. But just going through this, there's just insane stuff. Like, like, here's a part where my dad is like really depressed because he didn't get a job at something called Space Labs. I don't even know what that is.
Space Labs.
Am I making this up? Was my dad an astronaut?
I feel like Space Labs is a thing we know.
Here's me joining Boy Scouts because, there's talk of like putting together a trip to New Zealand,
So
the following year.
High school.
Yeah. This is all middle school to freshman year of college.
Are you an Eagle Scout?
No, I was immediately quit, but I had forgotten that the reason I started going was because they were trying to gin up talk of an actual overseas trip.
Oh, you tried to snake a free thing.
Do you want to know what happened on Tuesday, February 14th?
Of what year?
I guess we can find out because of what it says.
I mean, it's Valentine's Day.
1989.
Okay.
Dale Ellis scored 27 points in the NBA All-Star game, but Karl Malone took the MVP, and I was very angry about that.
That's your Valentine's Day tweet?
Pretty romantic. Well, I was in eighth grade. What are you doing Valentine's Day in eighth grade? It's a Tuesday night.
In Valentine's Day in 1989... I was in college. Yeah. I was in college. I was at Gonzaga University.
I feel like there's a lot of Harriet the Spy approach to journalism here, where it's just like, let me write down hot takes on all the kids in my class, all the teachers at school. Apparently, Side 2 of Abbey Road is my third favorite Beatles song. And yeah, that's right. I'm going to count it as one song.
It's a great song.
It's a great song. But I feel very pleased with myself for saying that that's a single song.
My daughter is 11, as you know, and she just read The Diary of Anne Frank a few months ago. And then
I should have read that instead of Harriet the Spy. That was my mistake.
She immediately reread it. And I think maybe The Diary of Anne Frank influences all kids writing diaries because it became a book read by millions, and it's just her diary, and she's clever. But what made it a book read by millions is subsequent events. And I think
she was living through unprecedented times.
Yeah, and I think there's a sense when you keep a diary, especially if you do this, like, dear reader, what you're hoping is that there's some future. Either that you achieve some future greatness that makes these diaries prized, like Kurt Cobain's stupid lyric books that all got published in facsimile, or I don't know that you're a witness to history, but I don't think anybody wants to know that Karl Malone was MVP. I think that's it. That's recorded elsewhere. That's the problem with my Hitler stuff. It's like, people have heard of Hitler.
Apparently the day I saw the Nicholson Batman movie was the same day we went out, took my grandmother out to Chinese. She was 58.
She was 58.
It was pretty good, but like most Chinese American food, bland. That's my hot take from July 18th, 1989.
So it wasn't Szechuan.
Apparently not. I don't think my Texas, Oklahoma grandmother wanted such fun food for her birthday.
She was 58.
When I was a kid, I was told to keep a journal.
Oh, by your school or by your folks?
Not by folks. I think there's a tradition in Mormon culture specifically of, you know, keeping a record of your life. It ties into the emphasis on genealogy and
but also your
and family, you know, history and
frontier idea that got to leave a record.
And that was what my parents always said. And I was like, why would I? Nothing happened to me today. And my mom would always say the same thing. That's what Laura Ingalls thought. You know, she thought she was just having a boring day, you know, milking the goat or whatever. And yet you read those books and you're just transported because what you think are the mundane details of your life are in another place in time. Fascinating. And I suppose that's the whole conceit behind this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really bought it from my mom. Oh, really? Like, the best I can hope for is that my journals will be those kind of dull pioneer books I could never get more than a few chapters into?
Yeah, she's like, oh, don't you love Little House on the Prairie? And you're like, not really.
Pass.
Not really very many space battles in it.
Yeah, there's no Nellie Olson even in my own writing.
I always think back to that picture that got tweeted a couple of years ago of the traveling Wilburys with with their ages at the time underneath.
It was a shock to see my grandmother was 58 because I'm picturing her in her 80s.
Yeah, and Roy Orbison was 52 in that picture, and he seemed like, you know, he was, well, he wasn't going to live much longer, right? He died.
You can do it with the Golden Girls too. In
the 50s.
You know, when the Golden Girls start, they're all like 45, except for the one who played the mom. She was actually 41 and they aged her up.
Right.
But this idea of keeping a record of your life has become increasingly, oddly, it's become more, not less relevant in recent years because everybody turned into a journaler.
Right.
With the advent of blog culture and then social media.
A photo journal too became a crazy thing.
And that's really better. Like when you look back, what do you want to read? You know, this crap about how I did on my Spanish test or Steve Largent retiring, or do you want to read, do you want to see a family scrapbook, you know? Like the photos you always immediately want to see.
Yeah.
It was always the right technology for it.
What I want is to go back to 15-year-old me and have him write about his feelings in a way that I'm only capable of now.
Yeah.
When I was 15, I couldn't have written about my feelings.
Well, that's the argument for keeping the journal, because you could go back later and
be reminded
and interpret your reactions then through the lens of now.
Yeah.
And if not, your whole childhood's just gone. You're just going to forget. You know, you're going to remember one thing that happened to you a month.
The manuscript of The Walk has had almost no talk in it about my feelings. But when I went back to work on it, I started to put that stuff in. And then when I let people read it, and you know, over the years, I've let half a dozen people read it. The women I've let read it have always said, "Would you talk more about yourself, please? Like, that's what we're interested in."
And the men have said, "Would you talk more about Hitler?"
They're like, "Whoa, the Hitler stuff is cool. I don't know. I skipped through all the other stuff."
Who's this John guy?
So I started to write, you know, I started to put stuff in because I could remember, and it did trigger memories about, you know, well, this is kind of what I was going through emotionally. And it does improve, it improves the book, improves the story.
To. I mean, it would have to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why this is dull, because I'm actually not writing about the stuff that's just stewing in my head.
Tell me now how you felt on that cold winter day when you and your grandmother went to Chinese food and she was 58.
Apparently the food was bland.
You don't.
I was still trying to tell myself that the Nicholson Batman was good.
It doesn't trigger just the combination of the two, Nicholson Batman and Chinese food with grandma, doesn't put you in enough of a place where you can say like, oh, what a lonely boy.
If I had put down anything else, like if I had put down, you know, what theater did I see it at? You know, what did we get grandma for her birthday? There are no telling details in the book. It's, you would never have predicted that this person would become a writer. I guess you could have predicted he would have become a very mediocre writer.
Did you have, I know we've talked about our respective crushes on the members of the Go-Go's. You loved Belinda Carlisle, and I was preferential to Jane Weedland, but mm-hmm. Did you have crushes? You must have had crushes on little schoolgirls you were in your 30s. Yeah. No, at the time, right? Like when you were 13, you had a crush on a girl.
Yeah, and it was just, that was so embarrassing to even think about. You didn't even talk about your friend. You talked to your friends about it, and much less put it on paper.
So when you were 16, 17, did you have a high school girlfriend?
Not particularly.
No. So your first girlfriend was in college. Was your first girlfriend Mindy?
No. But not really. There isn't a lot of dating drama. There was hardly any dating at my international school.
Kathleen Edwards was there. She's a cute girl.
Yeah. Who was she dating? I don't even know.
Well, she was a lot younger than you.
We'll have to read her journal.
I don't think she was dating anybody because she was in eighth grade.
She was in middle school.
Although, who knows? You know, there were kids in my middle school that were dating, boyfriend, girlfriend.
Really?
In eighth grade, seventh grade even. I was so not. You couldn't be less dating than I was in eighth grade.
Right, Dungeons and Dragons. We've done the show. The modern obsession with, or the modern possibilities at least, of documenting every day of a life and just assuming you'll have that. I've been thinking about that lately because I've been missing not having the research material.
For what?
For anything. I have a friend who's an older guy, probably pushing 80, and he was telling me a story.
I thought you were talking about me. I have a friend.
He's pushing 80. He's an indie rocker. No, and he was telling a story about discovering some letters, taking out some letters he'd had for a long time from when his parents died. And it includes the letters his mom and dad wrote to each other during their courtship.
Right.
Which I'm sure they would have, maybe cringed at the idea of anybody else looking at either then or now. But he was taking out a reading with his kids, and they got a little misty about being able to get this window into grandma and grandpa's life. And you realize how valuable this stuff is. And I'm starting to realize now that I have, I have all these questions about my childhood, about my parents' childhood, about, their parents' upbringing. And right now I have my parents around, so I can shoot a quick. The other day when we did the MIA stuff, POW MIA stuff on the show, I texted my dad to be like, hey, tell the story of how the draft lottery worked and how you got a good number. What were the mechanics of that? And if you had asked me, do you know everything about your parents? I'd be like, yes, I'm good. I'm ad infinitum. I know about my parents. And yet in practice, every single time I need to know one of these things, I'm texting them because I don't have the stuff.
Yeah.
And you realize that this is going to be gone at some point when those people are gone. And my day-to-day stuff is going to be gone when I stop breathing. And you want there to be some record. And there actually is some utility for it. It's not just ego.
I think I've told you about finding, my dad was an amateur photographer, and after he and my mom divorced, he lived in Alaska, and she took us down to Seattle. And I find all these photos and all these slides that my dad took of his life between 1971 and 1977 when I moved back up with him. So 6 years. All these people that I never met, all close friends with my dad during the construction of the pipeline and the, boom years in Alaska.
If he'd been a Mormon or a scrapbooker, he would have labeled the back of every picture.
Right.
Obsessively. And this is Jim.
And there's no record of them. And then there are clearly women that he's close with, right? Like people he's dating, people that he's in long-term relationships with. Maybe some of them even are still alive, and they knew my dad as well as anybody, and I have no idea who they are or where they are.
That's the crazy thing about record keeping, is that to me, I have like a bunch of cringe journals and a bunch of badly framed photos from the film era, and yet to somebody in 50 years, it's going to be like, this is a tantalizing treasure trove, like
Carl Malone.
I mean, not the stuff about the 1988 All-Star game, but yeah. Wait, why does he say this about his relationship to his sister? Like, what actually happened,
Well, my mom wrote letters back and forth with her grandmother for 40 years.
When people wrote letters, there was more of a paper trail.
You got a letter and you sat down and wrote a reply. But she says, reading back, that her grandmother's letters are all just farmer's almanac stuff. Like, well, yeah, we've, got a new foal and snow came 3 days early and
learning goes wilder.
Yeah. And there's no narrative really. It's just reports.
I mean, I think what you do, this is what my grandmother did before she died, not eat a bland Chinese meal, although I'm sure she did, is she wrote a very elaborate family history and she gave everybody bound copies and we were all super polite. Oh, thanks,
my
grandma.
Uncle did this too. Yeah.
And, it sat collecting dust in a drawer. And I just thought, kind of a booby prize, a vanity project.
And yet
now that she's gone, like that's super valuable because that's all I have when I have questions about her life,
It's more than just ancestry.com.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's, she went back and did, it's remembering conversations with these people, it's her echoes of two or three generations that are lost to me via conversation and memory.
That's cool.
And there is sort of a lot, but even the nuts and bolts of, here's why I had to leave the Marine Corps and when, you know, if somebody asked me, your grandmother was a Marine, when did she get out? I'd be like,
the end of the war.
Might be a great story, you know, and if she hadn't done that. So I guess arrange to know when you're going to die and turn your life into narrative. It's the memoir impulse. But, you know, today we've all got unlimited access to photos and vacation descriptions and bragging.
But maybe not the why.
Yeah.
I think about this a lot. Like, the one thing we don't know, or the things we don't know about each other, like, I don't know, for instance, I don't know if you're good at kissing.
There's only one way to find out, John.
Talk to Mindy, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But the thing is, Mindy's never going to say, there's no situation where she's going to be like, you know what? Ken's really good at kissing. You can look at you and tell what a good kisser you probably are.
With these full, luxuriant lips.
Mm-hmm. And just your passion. You're just the passion that comes off of you. But it's a big part of being a person. Kissing. Are you a good kisser? Do you kiss a lot?
It's easily 65% of being a person.
Yeah, certainly 65% of being a married person. Like,
and the rest is sandwiches.
There are people that aren't good at kissing that don't even like kissing. And then there are people that all they think about is kissing.
Yeah, but nobody thinks they're bad at kissing. Nobody's going to write in their journal, well, I'm pretty bad at kissing.
Sadly, that's true. And it's just like politics. The people that,
the wrong ones,
that think they're the best at it are not.
Is there a batter Minot syndrome for kissing?
But, you know, everybody's got so many hot takes. When your kids great, great, great grandkids say, what was Ken going through? My great, great, great grandfather. They're going to get all your hot takes on the new season on the WB. But what do they want?
Like, they don't want to know what I think of the Claremont Burn X-Men run.
Right.
Which is what a lot of my high school notebooks are going to be about.
Yeah.
But the question is, why are you doing it? You know, are you doing it for you now? Is it helping you just put your thoughts in order? Is it something to look back on a few weeks later?
Yeah.
Is it something to look back on later in life and remember, like I'm doing now? Or is it something for future? And if so, who does it serve?
Right.
Is it your own mythology or is it what your kids are going to want to know about you? Does it need to protect your feelings at that point if you've been dead 5 years, 105 years?
Oh, all the great letters that were burned by somebody, you know, to preserve Oscar Wilde's privacy or whatever. And you're like, come on, who cared about his privacy?
Plus, if you think about the letters that were burned for being hot and you read them now and it's probably like, my soul throbs. And exactly. She was like, well, I'm ripping up this one.
My handkerchief is so damp.
I toss and turn on the pillow at night. She said pillow.
But you know, that stuff, I mean, so much of that was probably performative, right? Because they weren't actually having sex. But we're not yet, despite all of our confessional culture, we're not yet able to really talk about our feelings.
I think that's because we've ramped up the performative nature too. When you think about what replaced diaries, it was social media, which is all about, you know, what I want to make sure other people are thinking of me
right
now. Here's my pose. Mindy had an issue the other day where she went to lunch with a friend and they had kind of decided they were not going to put anything on social media because, you know, just for FOMO of the people who didn't come to lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And her friend was like, you know, just put up photos. And Mindy was like, well, I thought we said we weren't okay. I thought we said we weren't going to do the... There's just this compulsion to share your life and to feel like the things that are happening to you are not actually happening or have no actual value unless they have been translated into social media. Basically, until you move your life into the metaverse, it didn't happen.
But you don't do this. You don't have an Instagram account.
I don't.
You don't put your, like, I made pasta. You don't do any of that.
You know what Mindy does, which is pretty genius, which is best of both worlds, is my... lovely and accomplished wife got turned onto this app called Day One, where you can upload photos and any captioning or text you want, journaling text you want, and it is only for you. It just lives on your phone. So you get the feeling that you're doing social media because you found a fun picture of your fun lunch or your goofy friend that you were hanging out with, and you can put that on social media and put a fun caption, and then it'll always be there to look back on and remember the good times. But no one is going to judge you for it.
Yeah, but 100% you're going to get an email one day that says, our company is going belly up, right. And you have 3 days to download this.
Well, I thought it would be worse than that. I thought it would be like, okay, we've now figured out everything about you, and we've sold all your DNA to to Elon Musk's Starlink system. The lasers are operational at dawn.
I mean, it would be great to then download that and publish it into a book and then have that be a photo album, you know, on your shelf like your grandmother used
to have.
I think
when you're browsing, you may want something to page through. And you know, there's companies that do that.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that? Like we often give gifts, you know, Mindy will go through and get a bunch of pictures and make a little scrapbook and send it to grandma and grandpa.
The motorcycle trip I took last year that I've probably talked about on the show.
Did you make a little lace scrapbook of your motorcycle trip?
I didn't, but Gregor, the guy who you know, arranged it and was the kind of leader, he made this beautiful hardcover book that he sent to us all. And it's just like, and he...
I love that he's a motorcycle guy, but he's making you guys a Shutterfly.
He's a great photographer. And so, you know, so he took pictures of every meal. But also, he found a way to make every single one of us look heroic. Yeah. So you're flipping through the book and you're just like, whoa, I had no idea I looked so cool. And look, everybody looks cool. Like he got the picture with every time you wheelied over a stump or whatever, he was there. And it's a great book.
The new emphasis on pictures really is a result of actually being able to find pictures of you that look good.
We all take 400 pictures.
Right. And then nobody younger than us really understands what it's like to just get 20 pictures back and they're all bad. And you have to put one in the family album, but somebody's looking in the wrong way and somebody has red eyes.
Every single one.
And there's a thumb.
Blurry, you know, like when you frame it, you think this is a great photo, but in the end you cropped it wrong and the person is tiny and...
Like we all have what would have been coffee table, National Geographic quality photos taken of us every day.
35 mil. Well, yeah, but I mean, the pictures probably, 35 millimeter films probably way better.
Yeah, no, we all have, it's like we're all the subject of a coffee table book now because we have good pictures of ourselves every day if we want it. Not a luxury available to past generations.
Ken, you know I'm a writer.
Yes, you love making content. The world doesn't have enough and you're like... Here's the fire hose. Here comes some content.
The thing is, I make a lot of content, but I don't put it in the fire hose because I want a more integrated community, and I don't know where to find it.
Are you saying you would like some kind of fully integrated commenting system that allows for threaded comments and replies and likes, like you have your very own little social media platform for your content?
That's exactly what I want to do, and I want it optimized for mobile. I want my content to adjust so my site looks great on any device, but I'm at a loss.
You, John, need the powerful blogging tools of Squarespace. It's easy with Squarespace to set up a website that does all that. Categorize, share, and schedule your posts. You can cross-post so you put something up once and it knows how to send it in the right format to Twitter or Tumblr or Facebook, whatever you want. Everything optimized and tagged and ready to go. Squarespace sounds great.
It does. Well, I'm so excited. You know, this is exactly what I've been looking for. So what do I do?
John, I want you right now to head to squarespace.com/omnibus. Stop whatever you're doing. Go to squarespace.com/omnibus and start your free trial. And when you're ready to launch, then you just use offer code omnibus and you're going to save not 2, not 5, but 10% off your first purchase of a Squarespace website or domain.
Well, thank you to Squarespace for supporting Omnibus and the Omnibus Project. Help us by helping yourself. Go to squarespace.com/omnibus and put in the offer code Omnibus to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So I was on Instagram for a long time and I really enjoyed it. It was like one of the friendliest places online. Mm-hmm. People generally were supportive and I enjoyed keeping a record of, I would actually go back to the Instagram and see what I was doing on at certain points. It was a valuable resource.
They know this is a use case because they'll send you things like 2 years ago today, look at you and your friends at the zoo.
But when I left social media last year, I also left Instagram, even though I liked it there. Mm-hmm. Because during the Bean Dad thing, I got 40 people that I'd never seen before that were like, you should have your daughter taken away. And so I was like, well, this isn't a safe space anymore either. And I miss it. I do. I miss it.
You can do what I do, which is lurk there just to see your friends' pictures.
Yeah, but I don't want to see pictures of people's flowers and pets. You know, I want to be...
It's my nieces and nephews, John.
I want to be part of their lives. And I want, you know, I was... Somebody texted me the other day. I hadn't heard from him in a while. And I was like, hey, how's it going? And she said, well, if you were still on Instagram, you would know. And I'm like, well,
how dare you ask me in written or oral speech?
I'm like, yeah, but you're texting me. We're friends, you know, send me a little update. And she's like, well, go on my Instagram. And I understood.
Do the work, John. Sit your white ass down and do the work.
I understood what she meant, you know? And I was like, yeah, yeah, I should.
That's on me, I guess.
See every picture of your dog.
Well, the forerunner of today's, standard of exhaustive documentation of our lives was R. Buckminster Fuller. Richard Buckminster Fuller.
Come on. He was busy making buckyballs.
Right. We think of him as an inventor.
Yeah.
Although the funny thing about being a full-time theorist and futurist is you don't actually have to invent anything that works. And Fuller, in fact, did not.
I saw a buckyball the other day, and it almost looked like it had once been inhabited.
No, that's not true. We should explain to the future that for much of the 20th century, our idea of future, philosophizing of the future came from one American man who loved geodesic domes. And Epcot Center was built during that time. Like, that's why all of our future looking stuff from like a 30-year period all has a very particular aesthetic.
Well, the new Amazon is just exactly.
It's a big buckyball with plants in it.
Yeah.
It's Fuller meets Biodome.
But he was like, Mr. The Earth is a spaceship, right?
That was his great guiding principle in his own looking back on his life. He told us that he had devoted his life to the idea of spaceship Earth. And it's true, this is a phrase that did not exist before Fuller.
It's like, kind of doesn't exist anymore. We used to say it all the time.
Because it's goofy. But just this idea that we're all in this together, traveling through... I mean, it's a metaphor you could not have had before the space age. Imagine that we're right. all traveling through space at 66,000 miles per hour on this craft that has a certain number of resources. All the sun, all the energy comes directly or indirectly from the sun. That's all we have.
This sounds like an episode of Schoolhouse Rock.
That's kind of the vibe when you look back at his writings. And he says, I'm going to bring to bear my keen mind on this big picture that only I can see, which is we have this many resources. We need to make life as good as possible for everyone. And we can do it. We're just not doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's proto-internet.
It is. it's kind of the, yeah, all these internet big thinkers are kind of Bucky Juniors.
Yeah, right.
And he had specific, as kind of the leading futurist of his time, he had specific ideas. He had coined the word dimaxion at some point in the 40s or 50s for these kit-built houses as a portmanteau of, I think, dynamic and maximize and tension. Dimaxion.
Uh-huh.
And that became an all-purpose prefix for all of his forward-thinking stuff. He invented...
It's like a Quonset hut.
Yeah, it was just a kit-built house. But he later went on to build Dimaxion cars, which was just kind of a little three-wheeled thing that never existed beyond a prototype, but it could...
I think I've seen that.
It could turn on a dime.
Yeah.
It's still kind of jibes with the idea of what a future efficient pod car from Minority Report might look like. His Dimaxion map was a better projection of the world, kind of expanded out into pentagons, not unlike a geodesic dome.
Right.
The dome was really the only idea that caught on in the American landscape. You probably remember driving around in the 70s or 80s and seeing the occasional person putting one of these up in the suburbs or the exurbs.
Yeah, you can still find them in Washington if you, as I do, look for land on the water in Kitsap County.
Is this nationwide? Because I only think of these as being a Northwest phenomenon, but they must have been everywhere.
They were everywhere. They had them in Alaska, but I think they're really common in places like Iowa and North Carolina. I mean, I feel like, but it's hippies. It's always hippies. So wherever hippies could be found in those times, Asheville, probably, their geodesic domes all around Asheville in the hills.
A certain type of sufficiently moneyed and scientifically oriented hippie. You know, the answer is not to reclaim some old homestead. We need to look ahead.
Yes.
You know, what's going to make life better? And Buckminster Fuller will show us the way.
But they always leaked and got covered with moss, right? Or is that just in the Northwest?
Windows were tricky, right?
Yeah.
If your house is little tiny pentagons strung together, decorating's difficult. No two walls meet at a right angle. Fuller was born in 1895 in Milton, Massachusetts, just kind of a tony enough suburb that it's also the birthplace of George H.W. Bush.
Uh-huh.
He came from an illustrious line of New England thinkers. In fact, he was the grandnephew of Margaret Fuller, essentially the first American, the inventor of American feminism.
Oh.
In a better world, the show would be about her, John.
I know. Does this show pass the Bechdel test? No.
Here, we'll do it. I'll be Margaret Fuller. You'll be another transcendentalist woman.
Okay.
Hello, Eliza.
Hello.
Why are you a pepper pot from Monty Python?
How are you?
Women perhaps should have the franchise. What think you, Eliza?
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Bechdel test. But he came from a family of transcendentalists. And being born in 1895.
Any relation to the Fuller Brush Company?
Yes. Uh-huh. In fact, okay. They also invented, I didn't even know what that is.
The Fuller Brush?
Yeah, but what are they all kinds of brushes. A guy comes with a briefcase full of brushes. I know this, but is it everything? Is it like cleaning out your car and brushing your teeth and vacuum attachments?
Yeah. The Fuller Brush didn't.
Paint brushes? Like one company can't make every kind of brush.
It was like a vacuum, except it wasn't electric. It was just like a push, like whack, wonk, 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 wonk.
Like a carpet sweeper?
Yeah. Like a sweeper, but not electric, just a sweeper.
I have no idea if this is true. I think we're going to have to do a Fuller Brush Company.
Yeah. All right. I'll put that on the list.
Omnibus. Being born in 1895, he often described his life as, being born at the perfect time just to see the world change.
Oh, my God.
1895 was also the birth of radio, the first consumer automobiles, the curious discover x-rays.
He was 20 when World War I started, so he saw the fin de siècle.
He served in World War I, in fact, which is, which again, in his own account, becomes a huge turning point in his life. Well, starting a little earlier, he was always interested in his perception of his own life, as maybe many kind of self-mythologists, the kind of people who become famous often have a plan to do so. Mm. And he was certainly one of these people. You see hints in his early life. At 4 years old, he was very farsighted as a child. At 4 years old, he finally got prescription lenses and put on a pair of glasses and was shocked to see the world. You know, that he was now a different person because he could view and interact with his surroundings in an accurate way.
He could see the gnomes that he only suspected were hiding in the rafters.
Lingering just out of sight. He frames this as a very formative moment for him that really our perception of the universe is all how clearly we can see things. And that influenced his record keeping. When his father died in 1908, he inherited all of his dad's correspondence and started indexing those letters. In World War I, he was in the Navy, and, you know, the armed forces can look at you for about 5 seconds and see, this is somebody who should be collating and alphabetizing things, right? You need to write our battalion newsletter and not be one of these guys over here.
Into the Nerd Corps with you.
He looked Nerd Corps enough to join the Nerd Corps, and as a result, he later did command some kind of a shipwreck retrieval? A crash rescue boat, the USS Inca. But if he spent most of his time in the Navy editing the newsletter, alphabetizing files, and he really kind of found a lot of, he never says this, he must have found it intensely satisfying. Because it is great. I'm doing the index for my latest book right now. And boy, nothing feels better than producing order from chaos in the form of a neat index. Most authors hire somebody. I don't trust anybody to understand my book well enough to alphabetize it. So he must have found it satisfying, but when he discusses it later, looking back, he just talks about how all this chaos would have produced no value. And suddenly, through his organizing principles, it became just an endlessly exhaustive and useful trove of information. So we can see evidence, contemporary evidence, because as we'll see, he left a great record of his life, that his interest in record keeping is growing over time. But he often presented it later as a road to Damascus kind of epiphany. In 1927, at a low point in his life, he's actually considering suicide.
Oh.
And in his own record of it, he decides to be reborn as a different kind of man. You know, his concerns will be larger. He's not going to be one of these regular rat race guys just trying to keep his head above water and to keep his family fed. His concern will not just be his own, but in a much more broad-minded way, the entire human race. And this is the beginning of all the spaceship Earth stuff.
That was a time when you really could decide to do a thing like that and not have a bunch of people on the internet roll their eyes at you. Yeah. Or even your cynical Generation X friends.
You're not going to know 10 other people having the same silly idea. There were fewer people with the same idea. Like he legitimately was ahead of the curve of thinking, of having this kind of 20th century Starfleet utopianism.
Yeah, right. The Earth. And I guess the airplane and the telegraph and all that would have been maybe the first, would have inspired people to think of the Earth as small.
So he commits what he refers to as an act of ego suicide.
Yes.
He is no longer a selfish, you know, bundle of fluids and squirting urges.
Oh.
He is now interested only in the omni-physically successful, spontaneous self-integration of all humanity into a one-town world.
Kapow!
He has a mission statement, and he frames it later in life, looking back, as an experiment. He is going to run a... He figures he's got... Actuarially, he figures he has 42 more years to live. And in fact, it turned out to be... Let's see, he died in 1988, I think. So it turned out to be closer to... Oh, he died in 83. So it turned out to be closer to 56 more years.
Okay. Go, man.
To devote to a half century experiment with no capital backing in which he would become guinea pig B.
Who is guinea pig A?
I wondered the same thing. My speculation was that, well, guinea pig A is the...
A real guinea pig.
Is doing the... No, yeah, it's an actual guinea pig.
Named that, Cinnamon
that
Toast.
That he will murder. That he will dissect. No, the guinea pig A is normal people doing their normal lives, whereas he is guinea pig B trying a different kind of approach to the universe.
Oh, guinea pig A maybe was Buckminster Fuller in a on a different timeline.
Ah, multiverse of madness.
Yes.
In fact, from what I... His book called Guinea Pig B Never Explains the Nomenclature. I think it may just be B for Bucky. I think it may be Guinea Pig Buckminster. You know, there's a bunch of test subjects running around the maze. The Guinea Pig B is going to be doing his own thing.
How is Guinea Pig B not a Guinea Pig Buckminster not a band?
Guinea Pig what Buckminster.
What a great band name. Nobody could ever say it twice. Guinea Pig Buckminster.
And he realizes, as he writes, you know, close to his death in the 80s, writing back on this act of ego suicide, he decides then he realizes in his new life, if this is going to be a rigorous experiment, of course you need experimental data, you need records, and nobody's going to be recording this. He right. doesn't have a staff.
He didn't have a graduate student in a white lab coat.
He doesn't. I mean, the funny thing is later he does. He actually does.
Right.
By the end of his life, he does have a small staff in full time devoted to documenting.
No.
Guinea pig B.
Really? How many sheets of toilet paper he used, et cetera?
Exactly. So he decides he's going to have to be his own lab team. And so he begins what he calls the chronophile. And he already is an obsessive record keeper. He's got his dad's stuff. He's already been keeping all his correspondence and stuff. But now it's got a name. It's the Dymaxion chronophile, a new kind of life well examined. And he's just going to keep everything because the subject of the experiment, the guinea pig, it's not for him or her to judge which data is important in the moment.
Right.
You won't know.
No.
A smarter experimenter might know, and certainly posterity will know by definition. So you've just got to keep everything. So he begins to keep a series of bound volumes.
There are so many different posterities, though.
Right.
What people in 1980 think is important isn't what we think is important in 2020.
That's why you can never throw anything away.
Right.
If you keep all the raw data, then future experimenters will have access to your uncurated work. So he keeps every single piece of correspondence. He keeps all his sketches and marginal doodles, which I presume are not of Captain America.
with a thick, very broad and chest small. Of Captain America.
all the marginal notes from every newspaper he ever read. He has a news clipping service send him everything about himself or other issues of great theoretical or philosophical import. All the blueprints for his works, of course, all the models he makes, all the recordings. When he does events, he has them send him a poster. He keeps, towards the end of his life, when he's a successfully branded thinker, he keeps all his merch. You know, there's every t-shirt that ever said, I am a verb, an evolutionary state of being, or whatever the famous Fullerisms were. Every manuscript, thousands and thousands of photos. And he begins binding everything that's on paper into a series of 12 by 10 by 5 volumes, which begin to take over the shelves of his apartment on 88th Street and on the Upper West Side. His kids remember just these brown leather volumes with soft green covers that just have everything. And his goal was to reconsider his life every 15 minutes, you know, that the chronophile would contain a record 15 minutes by 15 minutes of his life.
Whoa.
And that would include nighttime too, because he was an experimenter with Dymaxion sleep. He tried prophasic sleep where you get more rested by getting extremely tired than taking a brief nap that plunges you directly into REM sleep. And then you're back awake for another 2 hours of productive labor on designing the future of the species.
How did that pan out?
He only did it for a few years in the 40s, it seems. But for those years, he's got records of every 15 minutes, even at 2 a.m. I've often wanted to experiment with it, but it's not for a family man.
Dymaxion sleep.
People who try it say that you do, in fact, you know, he was saying, I get 22 hours of Buckminster Fuller thought and productivity every day now. And people do say it's good for productivity, but maybe it also induces paranoid schizophrenia. I don't know.
You sleep for 15 minutes and then you pop back awake and work for 2 hours and then you sleep for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But you have to do that on a 24-hour clock, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the world doesn't adapt to guinea pig B, so you've really got to be your own man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or woman. If we want this to pass the Bechdel test.
Sure. It still hasn't, but yeah.
I don't know if you remember those two transcendentalists, but they were very early to women's suffrage. By the end of his life, he had a staff that was treating it as an archive, cross-referencing it. You know, by the time he died, there were 13,500 cross-reference index cards.
He must have moved it at some point out of the Upper West Side.
Right. Where did he wind up? In the Midwest, I think? Carbondale, Illinois? Is that where he died? He ended up in California, but I think he spent a lot of the middle of his life in Illinois. So yeah, this must have been a guy with just a garage full of boxes of junk, so many men of his generation. Although in his case, it was literally, you know, 2,000 feet of shelf space in paper alone.
What keeps Buckminster Fuller from being thought of as an outsider artist? Right? Like, there are people that have this stuff and it's discovered when they're dead and it's just like, wow, what a genius. But I guess he was a genius in his time. So it just ends up being a quirk.
Because he was so busy making things shaped like geodesic domes, you know, from houses to desk calendars to power plants, the chronophile just seems like one of 100 crazy ideas that he had.
Right, right, right. And it didn't intrude on him building the Montreal Expo biodome.
And it really didn't, it doesn't come up in his work. When you read contemporary accounts of his life, the chronophile is hardly ever mentioned. It's only later in his 80s that he starts to write about this great turning point he reached. And in fact, I think that's because there is a lot of grandiosity and kind of self-magnification of the narrative going on there. You know, it's a better story for him to say that when really he's just a pack rat.
Yeah.
He's really just a hoarder of every dry cleaning bill and every doodle from a hotel notepad. And he turned that into an ethos in hindsight. And by that time, he had a staff that could take care of it. In 1976, his daughter, Allegra, took over and really inherited, you know, a mess that she didn't know what to do with.
Right. Her father's trash.
He had spent enough time with, he and she had both spent enough time with the luminaries of the 20th century to know that, well, Jonas Salk has an institute. Maybe he would want this. Henry Ford has a museum. Maybe they would want this. And their requirements were that the whole thing had to be kept together and it had to be preserved in an optimally effective way for all humanity, forward compatible.
Did he live long enough to recognize that digitalizing it was at least the direction we were headed?
He must have known, you know, because he lived till 1983.
Yeah, so did he ever put it on floppy disks?
I don't know if he ever did. I mean, at that point, maybe some of the speeches he was giving were coming from WordStar. Mm-hmm. So maybe there are...
Photostats weren't...
We need somebody at the Stanford Library to tell us...
Is that where it ended up?
It ended up at Stanford, because they would keep the collection together and agree to his conditions about how this had to be openly available for research, and it has to, you know, it has to fulfill all my... Because he's got all these mission statement goals about, you know, it has to address our issues of energy shortage, but also it has to be efficient. You know, he was really interested in living the most effective life, because if humanity lives an efficient, effective life, then we have resources and prosperity for all. And that even went to his archive. So Stanford agreed and put out a big press release about this very exciting collection. By this time, it is 200,000 letters, 150,000 clippings, 4,000 hours of audio and video, 15,000 photographs. It's just miles and miles of Bucky. And it's there today, and it's open to the public.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean...
Just go see... You can put in a cassette tape of Buckminster Fuller reading the phone book.
You can see his fast food receipts, I think. Pairs of eyeglasses. You know, Stanford got everything. So it's... The whole point of the archive was its completeness.
Right.
And the funny thing in hindsight is that we now think of Buckminster Fuller as kind of a quaint figure of the past. You know, like, I don't know what the modern day equivalent is, but he's nothing like Bucky in temperament or accomplishments. And yet his whole, the whole point of this was to live forever, because his was the new life, the man of the future. And nobody's ever right about that, I guess.
It's funny because there are inventors like Thomas Edison or Henry Ford, where we still live and interact with.
They actually changed the world.
Yeah, a facsimile at least of their invention. Yeah. Like a Ford still says Ford and it still looks like a Ford, essentially. And even though all these light bulbs are LED, they're designed to look like Thomas Edison's original creation.
Yeah, we're still living in Ford's world and...
But there are all those mid-century Edison's inventors world. That were like the auto car, you know, the
domed cities under the sea.
That it now seems so much like sort of weirder and out of time. But I could see where 300 years from now, if the Buckminster Fuller archives are still being maintained by future Stanford, that going in there and you know, and asking like how many times did he eat at McDonald's and where, I don't know, might be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, his ideas, maybe we just haven't reached his world yet. You know, maybe he seems old-fashioned now because we're not at his level yet, you know, because we were too slow to implement his ideas and his ethos.
But if you had like Dante Alighieri's receipts or Charlemagne's like dinner receipts, would you care?
Endless treasure, I think. Think how Shakespeare scholars obsess about, you know, the seven contemporary documents we have about him, you know, like, you know, if they found one extra church register that had one more line mentioning Shakespeare, it would just change the world of every English department in the world.
But that's because of scarcity.
Yes.
If we had 1 million pictures of Shakespeare at Coachella,
we would be so sick of him.
Yeah, where you're just like, well, there he is. There's Shakespeare, you know.
What you're saying is keep the exact right amount of stuff.
Yeah, we don't have
leave
enough
wanting more.
About Shakespeare, but we have too much about Paris Hilton. Like, how do you thread that needle?
Buckminster Fuller really should have spent a lot of his time documenting other people that we don't have enough of.
Right, but it would be...
Migrant workers.
I guess, or, you know, like all the people whose Instagram accounts are just their dog. Like, delete, 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 right? You're never going to want to see that. You're never going to want to look at 500 pictures of somebody's dog that died 100 years ago.
You mentioned outsider artists, and that's interesting because there are other people less luminary than Fuller who have tried his experiment. I mean, famously, a Fuller disciple, a sustainable architect, a famous architect of sustainable buildings named William McDonough, keeps a chronophile-like record of his life in imitation of Fuller. But many people are just cranks who do this. Let me introduce you to the Reverend Robert Shields of Dayton, Washington. I did not know where Dayton, Washington was.
Where is it?
Southeast corner.
Yeah, there's nothing exactly there.
North Oregon, we call it. Born in 1918, died in 2007, so 89 when he died. He was a, you know, he retired to Dayton. He spent most of his life in the Midwest. He was an editor for World Book Encyclopedia. He had all these amazing kind of faintly academic 20th century jobs. By the time he had been to divinity school. By the time he landed in Dayton, he didn't have a Congregationalist ministry anymore. You know, he performed the occasional wedding or christening or whatever. That's about it. You know, he taught part-time. He, I think, tutored kids. He did proofreading on the side. Just kind of retired academic stuff. You know, people, if somebody wanted their book gussied up before it hit the vanity press, he was the right neighbor for that. But he spent the last 20 to 30 years of his life in full-time documentation mode.
But there's nothing happening in Dayton, Washington.
That could possibly?
It's got like one street going one way and the other street going the other way.
How many people there? Like 1,000?
I bet not. Oh, maybe. Maybe 1,000. Maybe 2,000.
The smallest of towns.
It's got a train station. So it had 2,000 people.
In his abundant free time of his retirement, he spent documenting his life in 5-minute increments. So three times more detail than R. Buckminster Fuller.
Whoa.
And he wound up generating 37.5 million words. In other words,
guinea pig C here.
Yeah, guinea pig C. That would be enough. That's 30 times the amount that Samuel Pepys wrote about his own life. Every day he would walk out in his underwear to his porch, where he would sit on a kind of a horseshoe-shaped arena of 6 IBM, I think, memory 900 typewriters. You know, just so he would always have, you know, whichever way he was facing, he had a typewriter. If one of them broke, he had 5 backups.
This is a man after my own heart.
He would just record his body temperature and his blood pressure repeatedly. Anything interesting he found in the paper, he would keep all his new junk mail. He would write down the cost of everything he bought. He had a whole classification system for his urination and bowel movements, so he could describe every single one.
I'm starting to lose interest.
What? You were interested in his blood pressure, but not in his peeing?
Blood pressure is where my interest started to decline.
When we get to Reverend Shields' age, we will be so interested in our own peeing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I remember sitting with a group of my dad's friends, and they were all talking about their prostate for the 10,000th time. And I was like, you guys have lived phenomenal lives. Isn't there something else you could be talking about? And they were like, you just wait until you're our age. Your prostate will be the only thing you care about.
I had that experience at Jeopardy a couple of weeks ago. One of the producers was talking to the wardrobe guy at length about colonoscopies, and I come out of it and I'm just kind of smiling and nodding, and they're like, I'm sorry, we, you know.
Yeah.
Alex was in his 80s. We just got so used to talking about nothing but prostate.
Well, you're not 50 yet. And at 50, you have to go get your colonoscopy.
They've lowered it to 45. I have some terrible news
for
contemporary listeners in their late 40s.
Have you done it?
I haven't, because I just found this out, that it's not 50 anymore. It's 45.
They must have just done it, because I only had it done last year. I told you my story, didn't I?
No, but please don't.
I decided at the last minute, I asked the nurse, do you have to take anesthesia?
I think we did talk about this.
And they said, you don't have to. And I said, does anybody ever do it without anesthesia? And they were like, no. Why would you? And I was like, I'm going to do it. And so I had it done without anesthesia.
I just hadn't realized what a hassle it is.
I really don't recommend doing it without anesthesia. You're talking about, you have to drink the potion.
The day of not eating or drinking, and then drinking 8 pounds of barium or whatever it is.
Well, and you're not supposed to mess around with it. Like they can tell.
Yeah.
They can tell if you had a cookie. From what they see it.
I've been reading up on how, you know, for the time in your life when you're supposed to get a colonoscopy every 5 years in hopes of catching whatever growth early enough, instead of doing that, you could send in a sample every 1 year, and statistically, actuarially, you might be getting the same benefit, because, you know, samples catch stuff you know, can't catch stuff years in advance of becoming cancerous the way a colonoscopy can. But if you're doing that every year, it might be about the same risk as a colonoscopy every five.
You just sit out in your underwear on your horseshoe-shaped porch and...
putting poop in the mail.
Poop in a jar and send it to somebody.
He, Reverend Shields also tried prophasic sleep, mostly because he wanted to exhaustively record his dreams. So he would wake up every couple hours.
Write down his dreams.
Run to the porch and type out his dream and then back to bed. He kept, there's his records now include, he was on Oprah. Like he was kind of a famous outsider artist of the time for having this, this weird lifestyle.
But aware of Fuller and aware of,
I'm not sure. Fuller's archives. I'm not sure if he would have been aware of Fuller. I mean, he's an imitator. He must have known, right?
Because
he did a ton. He did enough media about this that somebody would have said, "Well, you know, the great Buckminster Fuller had a similar pursuit."
Right.
But he would, when, you know, every time he would ask, "Why would you do this?" He would just say, "Oh, you might say I'm a nut. We're driven by compulsions we don't know." So he was more honest. I actually like this about Shields, is that when Fuller is asked to explain why he's a hoarder, and, you know, self-mythologizing hoarder, he just talks about how here on spaceship Earth, we must all be so rigorous with our data and effective with our resources if we're to know truth. And Reverend Shields just like, I don't know, I just got to. I'm a big weirdo. He taped nasal hair into his document so that we could clone Reverend Shields if you have any questions for him.
It's weird.
He donated his full archives to Washington State University, which did not want them.
Doesn't sound like something that they, although they are doing a lot of weird stuff out there too with corn.
It turns out if you give Wazoo $100,000, they will keep and climate control your work.
Did he do that?
So yeah, he set up a perpetual trust to pay for them to keep his work, but it cannot be read until 2057, I presume because of how candid he was about his Dayton, Washington neighbors, and he wanted to make sure they had all passed on.
Oh, okay.
He had a series of strokes, at which point he started dictating the... In 1992, after a stroke, he spent his last 5 years dictating his archive to, I assume, a very patient spouse or caregiver.
And
finally died 10 years later.
In Pullman, Washington, there's a building with the air conditioners running that have...
That's 37.5 million words and an untold number of nasal hairs.
Jars of his poop. And it's all
he did not keep the poop. He just kept descriptions of the poop.
Oh. Okay.
He had a whole vocabulary for
it. There are people in Germany that would pay for that book.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to give them $100,000. You just get the German internet on the case.
And that concludes The Chronophile, entry 221.ES0601, certificate number 49146 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, all of your photos will be lost. No, wait. In the unlikely event that it does exist, your photos will... All those apps where you're taking a photo every day, that stuff will still be there. I don't think that will happen, though.
Does Earth have enough land area to hold all the server farms you would need to preserve this data?
No, I think... Well, you know what it'll do? It'll be put into quantum computers... that are dancing on the head of a pin.
Like actual objects will just hold, you know, like you'll have a little a lump of meteorite on your keychain.
Yeah.
And just the arrangement of the atoms is actually holding the quantum state of all your vacation photos.
And every person you've ever known.
Exactly.
But it's, you know, it would be cross-referencing, right? Like Mindy's account of you would be fascinating, but it would only be contextual if we had an account of Mindy to know how her perception of you was skewed. And then if you added my perception of you and my perception of Mindy.
But Fuller was right. That's why you got to keep the raw data. If you've got a data point from every 15 minutes, like that's why we can look back now and see that Fuller was not totally honest about his motives and his epiphanies, you know, because we can look in the chronophile and see it kind of develop over time.
Yeah.
So if you keep a rigorous enough record, you will have a fully holistic hologram of your life from every possible angle and data point.
But you need to post pictures of your friends at lunch, and they need to post pictures of you at the same lunch, and all of those things have to be hashtagged so that they can be combined into a 3D picture of you guys at lunch that you can access via...
So that if at any point you're taken out by a sniper, we can reconstruct the whole thing.
Yeah. Reconstruct you and the sniping
Reconstruct you and the sniper and have a little truth and reconciliation meeting. That will be the future, by the way. Joining assassins and their victims in the cloud to share their feelings.
Right, through AI.
Yeah, an AI Oprah will help JFK and Oswald work things out.
So when you shot him, how were you feeling?
What was going through your head, President Kennedy?
Well, all of a sudden, I feel like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are extremely important, and everyone listening should be filling those things.
Every 15 minutes, or five if you live in Dayton.
Put your pictures and thoughts about them up.
If you live somewhere incident-filled like Dayton, Washington, it's got to be every 5 minutes. Otherwise, 15's okay.
You can find some, but not exhaustive, but some documentation of our lives at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project. You can, on Twitter, you can find Omnibus After Dark. No, what's it called? Omnibus at Random. What is the...
Omnibus Out of Context.
Omnibus Out of Context on Twitter. Very hilarious, strange little excerpts taken out of context.
Many of which are made up and nobody has ever called them on it.
You can email us and tell us all about yourself because only Ken and Mindy will read it. They'll only send it to me if it has my name in it.
And it has to be nice.
And it has to
be
nice.
If it has your name and it's mean...
That's right. If it says John is wrong...
I save it to send you later when I'm mad.
That you can email us that at that email address, theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings and share your experience, strength, and hope at Omnibus Futurelings, wherever social media exists. I'm not going to tell you how to search for things on the internet. You can mail us things for our extensive archives, which we will end up sending to Washington State University.
We actually do have kind of an extensive archive of weird stuff.
Because I never throw anything away. Although you and I both went to the University of Washington. So that's who, except real estate in Seattle is very expensive.
Yeah, think how much you'd have to pay the University of Washington to keep all the weird restaurant placemats that Futurelings have sent us.
Yeah, right. Where would I guess we'll farm it out to the Palouse.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can send us things to PO Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. Do you have any mail, Ken?
Nah.
Oh, all right.
I'll save it for next time.
And you can support the show as we've seen. It costs $100,000 to endow your...
Just to keep nasal hair in a room.
Yeah, your poop archive. So imagine what Ken and I are generating just in terms of dander.
Dander alone. Our dander bill alone is through the roof.
We have very pink skin and it danders. It really does.
You might be allergic to us even now in your era.
But if you support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject, your support goes toward keeping our archives and also maintaining the show, which is itself an archive of Western Civ. Actually, of all Civ.
It's not very complete. We do this twice a week instead of every 5 minutes.
Right.
So
that seems more than most people.
So we may be falling behind, but we're gonna keep at it.
I still want to know if you're good at kissing or not.
Yeah, everybody's wondering. Everybody wants to know.
And is this going to be like Shakespeare? You're going to keep it?
You ask me as transcendentalist feminist Margaret Fuller if I'm good at kissing.
Ken, are you good at kissing?
Well, come over here, Margaret.
Whoa!
See?
Whoa!
We're going to be the talk of Concord, Massachusetts.
I did. Ooh, at all.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording with me kissing Margaret Fuller, with consent, by the way, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus